The Guardian.
Football Weekly with James Richardson.
Today, weekend of wonders. We round up all the drama from Mickey Owen's rum punch to Spurs' win at Spitalfield to noble Daniel Sturridge, who celebrated neither scoring against his old club nor getting a card for trying to cheat them. We ask, is the league over? Has the Liverpool comeback begun? We move on to news from Spain, defeat for Real Madrid and the Fuentes trial really heating up. Italy, Balotelli gets a brace, a starring role, a standing ovation and all the headlines. He's only gone out for a pint of milk. Cup of Nations, Ivory Coast out, the host out. What awaits in the semis? Your post, tweet and a special preview of England-Brazil. All that and more in today's Football Weekly. Welcome on board, everybody. Special pod this. Special. Greg Bukowski's here.
Hi, James.
Or should I say Greg Bukowski?
Bukowski. I answer to anything.
Right.
I just prefer Bukowski myself.
Because right.
I'm not actually Polish.
How does your wife pronounce it?
Bukowski.
Right. So you took her name, but in a gesture of kind of male independence.
Yeah, I wanted to keep something for myself. You know.
Right.
So
you still pronounce your surname roughly in a certain sense.
In a certain sense, yeah.
Okay. Also, Simon Burton. My word, it's been a while, Simon.
It has been a while. Yeah, I've been missing you.
Cool.
Yeah.
Good. Well, you're back today.
Indeed.
Right, let's make it count.
Yeah, why not?
Absolutely. And speaking of it's been a while, Fernando Duarte.
Hi there, guys.
Hi,
Long
Fernando.
Long time no see.
You're in a quiet mood today, aren't you, Fernando?
Yeah, let's wait for the caffeine to kick in.
Yay! All right. I have to say, we had a lot of things prepared to talk about today. But just before we go into our floating orbital pod station, Europol only going to announce, oh, by the way, we've been investigating for 18 months and all football's bent. There's 425 people they've identified and 350 matches. They could have told us before.
They could have done. Not that we could talk about it now.
Well, that's true. So, for latest on that story, for any updates, guardian.co.uk/football, I'm thinking, Simon, yeah?
That would be a good place to start. All but right. Anyway, we enjoyed watching it at the time.
We did, so, didn't we?
And that's the main thing.
It's a bit like saying, you've just been to see a terrific film at the cinema. By the way, it was all made up. Somebody wrote that story. It doesn't spoil the drama.
It would ruin everything for me.
Do you think it would?
Yeah. I saw The Hobbit the other day, and the fact that was a real-life story really made it for me as an experience.
Fernando?
What are we talking about again? Sorry.
I was
stuck on the ground for a long time today. And
while you were on your way in, Europol did this big press conference, which I think might even still be going on now, when they said, oh, we've just been doing the biggest ever investigation into corruption in football all across Europe. I think they've identified 380 matches. 425 people, they say, are corrupt, officials, players, etc.
How many of them in Italy, just as a matter of a...
They didn't specify that. They didn't specify that it was across Europe.
That would be a hat-trick in Italy, eh? If you think of Rossi, then Calciopoli, and then bam!
I think we're significantly beyond the number three in terms of the number of scandals there have been in Italy. But yes, I do take your point. You'd expect there perhaps to be some involvement from Serie A. They've been quite... certainly the English outlets have been quite heavy on the fact that there's at least one Champions League match played in England. Yeah, anyway, right. In the meantime, in our own little way, let's get on with what happened this weekend. First off, Greg Bukowski. Title race, is it over, etc., with Liverpool's stirring 2-2 draw at the Etihad?
I don't know if the title race is over yet, but I think Liverpool exposed a few problems that City have got. And first of all, it was a blisteringly quick, a highly entertaining match. And I think it doesn't pay me in any way to say it that I think Liverpool, the reason that the match was so good is because Liverpool decided to go on the front foot and were very positive in their approach to the match, which they haven't been in other games this season against bigger teams. I think from the start they were very energetic. In midfield, they dominated midfield for most of the match. And I thought Sturridge had a wonderful game. And he's been criticised a lot this season for some of his decision making at times. And I thought his decision making was very good. He passed the ball intelligently and he linked up really well with Suarez.
It was great to see that Liverpool actually taking the game to City. It's a shame that they haven't done that more often. Because I was just watching Being Liverpool FC the other day. Many people slagged it off, but I loved it. I loved that kind of like cheap documentary and Brendan Rodgers trying to sound like a statesman. But, you know, the only game that I watched this season that I felt like, you know what? they can do something interesting. It was against City, and it's nice to see that they don't bottle against the champions.
Well, is this not that two games in a row against big, big sides that Liverpool have been the better team
in? I'd say the beginning of the season. Against Arsenal, they were very good. At the beginning of the season, though, they played very well against City and did 2-2, and they played very well and outplayed United and got beat because they got a man sent off.
Right. So are they back now, Greg? Or how close are they to being back?
I think Rodgers would have looked at that performance and thought this... It'd be, you know, his the Rodgers vision or whatever, that was pretty close to what he envisaged. The thing that he's been unlucky with this season is he can't account for individual errors, and there've been a lot of individual errors that and Liverpool have been punished ruthlessly for him. I mean, like Reina, the way he came out, you don't normally get punished as quite as ruthlessly as that. But Aguero's finish was fantastic.
Was that the goal of the season, Greg? Was it?
It's up there because I don't think I've seen a goal scored from quite an acute angle as that since Kanu scored against Chelsea that time.
Yeah, a lot of people are making that comparison. Yeah. What do you think, Simon?
It was the flight of the ball was what made it beautiful. The way that it just plopped into the net without bouncing. Had it bounced on the way, it would have taken a lot of the beauty away somehow.
Right.
It was beautifully done, but I don't think that someone tapping the ball into an empty net, albeit from a crazy angle, can possibly be the goal of the season.
I don't know. It wasn't just the crazy angle. It was the fact that he was actually facing the wrong direction.
He was off balance as well.
Yeah, no, it was really amazing, but it won't be getting my vote.
What will be getting your vote, tough crowd, Mr. Simon Burton?
I don't know. I don't even think it was the best goal of the game.
Really?
Yeah.
Which goal was better than that? The Gerrard one?
Yeah, I thought Stephen Gerrard's strike was phenomenal.
Gerrard's.
And he had to deal with actual players and goalkeepers in his way.
What do you think, Fernando? What do you think?
I think Aguero's goal was brilliant. But then again, there's a caveat of an empty net. But I also love Stephen Gerrard. How can I actually go against my European Cup winning
captain? It's like Sophie's
choice. It's a bit nostalgic watching that Gerrard goal because it was such a flashback.
You know what? I'm going to go with Stevie Gerrard. It's almost a corked wine, but you still can get a decent glass out of it. So, cool.
City, though, the FA Cup, they're still in that. They're taking on Leeds in the next round. But League Cup's gone. Champions League's gone. Let's be frank. The title is pretty much gone. Were they playing, do you think, against Liverpool? A little bit like they thought the title was gone, like their season's over.
I don't know if they were. I think yesterday they badly missed Torre in midfield. I think the fact that, I think Garcia, he's supposed to be in there as a defensive midfield, but he couldn't cope with the energy that Liverpool had. I think they really missed Torre. I'd go as far as to say they shouldn't have sold De Jong last season, because in games when they haven't had the initiative, and they have the initiative an awful lot because they're a good football team, but in Europe, against Real Madrid, Dortmund, Ajax, etc., you need a player to break play up when you come up against a team who has more possession than you. And they didn't have a player like that against Liverpool yesterday. I'd argue they missed him probably against United at home this season. And that all comes down to the fact that they've got all this money and they can bring players in and out. And there's not really, there's maybe been too many changes made, and they're a little bit.
Although a lot of City supporters might point to the fact that there weren't significant changes made back in the summer, that there weren't significant additions made in the January transfer window. Daniel Sturridge, point of not celebrating when you then do a ridiculous dive?
Yeah, there does come a point where the blight of non-celebrating has to be. Someone has to call a halt to this nonsense.
Right.
I think that occasionally, and it is occasionally, a professional player forms a special relationship with a team and its fans. If, for example, Frank Lampard leaves Chelsea at the end of the season and comes back playing for West Ham next year and scores a goal and doesn't celebrate, well, there you go, fair enough.
Yeah.
But Sturridge is a player whose career has already passed. He's stepped on several stepping stones along the way.
Mm-hmm.
And they're fairly incidental. And for him to not celebrate against Manchester City while the fans are booing him.
Well, he gave quite a considered defence of it, saying, "This is where my career began. They gave me my start. I will never disrespect them by celebrating a goal against them. But I will take a bit of a tumble in the box to try and win a penalty."
I just don't understand the non-celebration, because it's not... If you... kind of do a bit of fist pumping or something because you're happy that you scored a goal.
Right.
You know what I mean? It's not like they're doing it.
Out
of spite. If you go celebrating right in front in the face, that's different. But I mean, you can just celebrate and be happy that you've.
For example.
Well, to be
Sturridge,
fair.
Sturridge non-celebrating or body popping?
Non-celebration every day. Yeah.
Good. Yeah. Let's move on then.
What's his name? His job's the striker, the Schalke striker, Kevin Kurani scored against Brazil. He didn't celebrate as well,
right?
Being a Brazilian born, even though his mum's from Panama, his father from Germany, and he was born in Brazil almost by accident. But it was interesting to see that. And the funny thing is, in the build up to that match, people are saying, oh, this guy is not even good to play in the Brazilian second division, and he scores against Brazil.
He certainly did. The only one I can accept is Dennis Laws back in the day when, you know, if you're going to relegate a club that you love, fair enough. So, you know, maybe don't celebrate. You don't want to see him go down. That's about it.
All right. Fair enough. Now, moving on, the race for third, fourth, etc. Chelsea losing at Newcastle. What a terrific game. I know, Greg, you really enjoyed the game at the Etihad. Chelsea, yeah. Newcastle, or Newcastle-Chelsea, that was a cracking match as well. Certainly, there was a case, perhaps, that Chelsea should have had a penalty, do you think?
Well, the thing is,
yeah.
When a player has a shot in the box, immediately after that shot is made, there's a free hit. Any defender can do whatever they like to him, and they will get no punishment as a result.
Oh.
And normally, he has a shot with his feet, and then a millisecond later, someone crunches through and takes away his legs.
Yeah.
And there's never a penalty. And the only difference in this case is this, he had his shot with his head, and then Colaccini kicked him in the head.
Yeah.
But it's fine. It's in the rules of the game, in a secret...
it's one of the unwritten rules.
If you get clattered in the head, generally they say it's dangerous play, so they give a free kick elsewhere on the pitch. So therefore, I'd say perhaps a penalty could be given, but not like people talking about sending off. And you know the fact he got booked, wasn't worthy of that. But it was dangerous play by the letter of the law.
Literally, barely a week goes by when I don't see someone just after they've taken a shot get their legs taken out and wonder why on earth was that not a penalty. And what happened on Saturday just confirmed that it is actually a rule enshrined in the game, but secret to all. But the players. You get a free hit. It was fine. Kick him in the head. No problem.
Top work, Simon. Yeah. We should say, though, terrific stuff from Newcastle. I mean, it was a shame for Chelsea they had to lose Barr and then Torres, etc. But terrific work from Newcastle. And Sissoko, God bless the Eurozone crisis from Newcastle's point of view.
It'll be fascinating to see if this was just a phenomenal debut by a player capable of reaching great heights but unable of sustaining them, which I guess is what a lot of people who have seen him play in France might say. Or whether he really is as good as he looks.
But it looks like he's got all the tools.
Yeah, he's been talked about for two or three seasons, and it's been surprising that he's not made a move before now. And the one thing I say, the only thing I've... Probably Camoli's made the good decision in the... Well, it was a bad decision. Liverpool didn't end up buying him, but there's two or three years ago, he was talking about Sissoko then as a player who Liverpool could buy, and I presume it was Dalglish who made the decision that Henderson was the better option. And you know, so he did have some idea back then that he was a good player. I was very impressed with by Newcastle. The way the three played, there was Gouffran, Sissoko, and I think Gutierrez had played in a more advanced position. And they were so pacey. Chelsea's defence couldn't really deal with the pace they had on the counter-attack. And I thought Newcastle were very impressive. But there'll be a lot of people saying that their scouting system, this is evidence that it's really good again. They brought in players really cheaply, were very good.
Mm-hmm.
I'd argue that still the way the clubs run, in the summer they... should have strengthened them because they'd had a very good season, very close to the Champions League. They were light in defence, and that's where they really needed to make sure the squad was strengthened. And they didn't really spend the money. I think they spent $5 million on Anita or someone. And they didn't spend the money back then, which would have enabled Newcastle to have not had this, you know, dire run which they've had when the defence has been very weak.
Well, they're now 6 points off the bottom three after consecutive wins. First time they've done that in 10 months. If memory serves. And, as for Chelsea, they find themselves now barely 1 point above Spurs. Spurs, of course, won away there at West Brom. Arsenal also won, so they're still in the mix there just behind Everton, who, of course, drew in that extraordinary game. We'll talk more about that with Aston Villa. A rubbish punch and a rubbish bit of spitting in the Spurs and Arsenal games.
Mm.
Yeah?
I've got an issue with the spitting.
Have you?
Well... You know, spitting is not a nice thing. It's disgusting if you get a glob of spit in the face.
Yeah.
But the way people talk about it is as if it's worse than having your leg snapped in two by a lunge. And I think it was Alan Shearer over the weekend said he should be banned for 6 matches for this. It's vile. Nobody likes to see that. I mean, I'd rather players who kind of break people's legs get banned for 6-9 matches. But I mean, spitting, he'll get banned for 3 matches and he won't do it again. That's enough.
Spitting or non-celebration? Where do you stand on that one, Greg?
Oh, you know what?
It's a tough one, isn't it?
Body popping. Yeah.
All right.
I think spitting is despicable. Yep. It used to be something that in South America was a mark of actually, I'm going to show you how I disrespect you.
Yep.
And it was a bit tolerated. Branco, the Brazilian left back, spat in the face of a Spanish, I think it was Michel or Salinas in the 1986 World Cup. And people in Brazil say, yeah, you know what? Yeah, show them. But now, it's just, I think it hurts the gentlemanship of the game. In these times, we're talking so much about how people should behave.
It doesn't happen very often, though. That's the thing. It's when it happens,
I go with you. It shouldn't be treated as if somebody just waves some
genitals on the pitch. And I should think, for example, in the case of somebody breaks their leg, the punishment should be proportional. If you get, for example, player a year off, you don't play a year off, mate, especially if it was right. like a vicious tackle.
What happens if you break a leg and then spit on the person?
Then I think that capital punishment should okay. be brought back.
All right. What about Michael Owen, who, being a proper English footballer, didn't spit at Arteta? He gave him a hearty thump.
Yeah, I thought it was quite interesting Sweet. To see on Match of the Day on Saturday night the people who occasionally sit next to Michael Owen when he comes on Match of the Day agreeing that it wasn't really a punch, and even if it was fine. I mean, it was a punch. So, yeah.
It kind of was. I guess it just about fits into...
Was it a punch?
It was an attempt at a punch.
Yeah. I see that. I mean, I've seen that happen so often on like Saturday and Sunday playing football right. when someone's just being clattered and you kind of throw your hand down at the player below you and... I don't know. I think people are making a bit more of it. And I'm no friend of Michael Owen, shall I say.
Oh, you're not?
But, yeah,
okay.
He's not. Yeah, I think they're making more of it than what's right. there.
Well, the big talking point anyway in the Spurs game, apart from the win and the pop-off business, was the fact that Defoe got injured, the Spurs fans chanting he should have bought a striker. Now, Adebayor will be coming back following Togo's exit from the Africa Cup of
Well,
Nations.
That's when the whole Damian thing comes into the picture,
right.
isn't it? I mean, I think Spurs could have got him. But well, from what I've heard from Brazil, the noises is that they wanted to condition the instead of paying up, they wanted to do some kind of performance bonuses clause. So and Inter doesn't have to sell Damião now.
This is Internazionale
Porto Alegre in Brazil, Damião's club. They don't have to sell it. What's happening is a very kind of like tidy club, even though they are a niche club in terms of supporter basis. They are amongst the five or six biggest earners in Brazil. So they do not need to kind of like just sell people in a hurry. Besides, they're going to get one of the World Cup stadiums as well, so they know there's going to be outcome. They don't need to panic sell. Actually, no club in Brazil at the moment needs to do. I mean, none of the big clubs need to do that in a hurry. So, on the other hand, they're not playing Libertadores. I'm sure that Damian wants to go out. I've seen him talking about, oh yes, of course, it's natural. I will have to play abroad one day. Mm-hmm. But the club won't sell him. And besides, he's also partially owned by an agent. Internacional only owns 70% of his right. thing. And it's amazing because this is a player who was playing Sunday League until 2008. He was drafted from a Sunday League team. And now we're talking about him playing the Premiership. It's
wow, imagine coming up against him on a Sunday. That'd be a bit of a shock, wouldn't it?
Yeah, just a bit, yeah.
It's inevitable. He says it's inevitable that he goes abroad. Is it now getting to the point where it's almost not inevitable? I mean, looking at Neymar, for example, who's making an incredible career
Different story. Well, the problem with Neymar is the brand Neymar is almost a Beckham-esque thing. I love this expression, Beckham next, whatever. Mm-hmm. He's become too important for sponsors as well. Neymar earns around a year, I think, 11 million quid a year, I think, right? I'm not because figures in Brazil are always kind of like, it's big money. And only 15% of that is actually put in by the club. The rest is sponsorship. Right. Santos said, okay, we're going to bring sponsors in. We're waiving our share of your image rights so you can make as much money as you want so you stay with us until the World Cup. And all these sponsors are putting money in because they want to cash in Neymar until the World Cup.
Right.
So the thing is, even if he wants to go, and I'm sure he does, he can't leave now. It's simple. He's got 11 sponsors. I mean, even a underwear, socks, car batteries, right. and then Volkswagen. He's got like 11 sponsors, and people are keeping him there. It's almost like the Pelé thing. In the 60s, Pelé was declared national interest by the government. Of course, we had almost a dictatorship there, and sometimes an actual dictatorship, so they couldn't just allow him to go. It's almost the same thing. I don't believe that he will go out before the World Cup.
But after the World Cup?
Definitely. I think the morning after the final, he's going to be wearing a Barcelona shirt.
Barcelona, really? Not Bayern Munich, as a lot of people are suggesting.
He does love Pep Guardiola, but I don't know if he's going to... Listen, he's a kid who never played abroad.
Right.
It's not like from middle class upbringing. So for him to parachute into Germany is something totally different. Even though Bayern's got like a little Brazilian cluster there with like Luis Gustavo and Dante now, who's been called up for England. We'll talk about him later on, but still. I still see him going to Spain. Spain's a much more natural destination for a Brazilian player, especially a superstar.
Well, fascinating stuff, Fernando. Do you know what? Let's bring part one to an end there. And so much more to come. As you mentioned, there's the England-Brazil game. There's the Africa Cup of Nations. There's the battle at the bottom.
And the surprise stat. Never forget the surprise stat.
There's a surprise stat.
Yeah.
And there's, why Watford are called the Hornets and playing yellow. All these delights to come.
Mm-hmm. This week on the Guardian Audio Edition, Jason Burke on Al-Qaeda and how great they are a threat to the West now. John Fordham sums up the legacy of the jazz musician Ahmad Jamal, and Brian Logan on Mrs. Brown's Boys, how the worst comedy ever made became a smash hit. And in this week's audiobook review, we return to the roots of cyberpunk with William Gibson's 1984 classic Neuromancer. To download for free the Guardian Audio Edition supported by audible.co.uk, go to audible.co.uk/guardianaudio. You can find us on iTunes, SoundCloud and Audioboo. The Guardian Audio Edition, a new way to get the whole picture.
Part two, then, everybody. Battle at the bottom. Villa, what a disappointment. The 3-3 draw with Everton. But how can they go down playing like that?
Well, they need to play like that more often, don't they? That's the thing. I mean, they played like that the last time was against Liverpool, and they were excellent. And against Everton, I thought they were really good going forward. Benteke was the midfield linked up with Benteke much better. But defensively, again, that was they still very naive in defence. And Anichibi, he was too strong for the young Villa defence. And I think on each of the goals, Villa's defence was found lacking. Physically, but I can understand Lambert afterwards being positive about it because they looked like they could score when they went forward, and they were very good. And the third goal was fantastic. The cross from Lowton from the right for Benteke. It was a little bit of a flashback because you just don't see goals scored like that often these days when a fullback kind of overlaps and plays a first time cross deep. You're looking like you didn't see it.
I'm just trying to remember what it looked like.
It was a very deep cross curled in perfectly for Benteke. You just stooped in front of Heitinga.
Oh, then, lovely.
Yeah, and headed into the corner.
It's getting lovely a bit goal. Late for them, isn't it?
What, Villa?
Yeah.
Well, you've got 13 games to go, is it now? And they are 2 points from safety, so, it's doable. If they're playing like that, as Greg says. Situation at the bottom, you've got Southampton are 3 points clear of the drop. Reading are 2 points clear of the drop after their victory over Sunderland. And Wigan, of course, drew with Southampton. They are now level with Aston Villa. Those two teams, 2 points of safety. Bottom of the pile, QPR, 0-0 with Norwich. They are now back to 6 points from safety, exactly where they were before Harry arrived, exactly where they were indeed before they broke their transfer record twice on Loic Remy, who's now gone out injured, and Christophe Samba, and oh dearie me. Still, Julio Cesar, thumbs up.
I still think they're gonna do it.
Really?
For some reason, yeah. I mean, they had a horrendous start. I mean, it should almost be like Leicester a couple of seasons ago when you knew they were going to go down, but somehow they seem to be pulling some interesting results. I mean, I just think that they need to get like the scruff of the neck.
Or some momentum. I mean, yes. they've had some great results. I mean, when they beat Chelsea, you think that's a turning point, and then they struggle afterwards. I mean,
they need to get that against
the points from safety.
Well, that's the thing.
What they have done in the last few weeks is proof that they can defend, which is if you can't keep clean sheets, then you're really going to struggle. And that's the problem with Aston Villa. They looked promising at the weekend, but the defence was still so shaky. So even on those days when Benteke plays a layer, every now and then he has these unplayable days. And if they still can't win on those days, then they're really in trouble. Whereas QPR, they've had clean sheets against Tottenham and Manchester City and
Chelsea and now
Norwich. Perhaps less of a big boast. But still, and they've just signed a man mountain centre-back.
Mm-hmm.
And that gives them a bit of hope. What they do need is Remy back because they lack a bit...
And they need to get points against the direct opposition for relegation. That's the thing. About Cesar, I think it was, if they stay up, he's going to be one of the candidates for sign of the season. I mean, nobody actually believed he could still play at top level after,
His form absolutely nosedived, didn't it?
The World Cup, he took a massive psychological hit after the World Cup. Remember, he arrived in South Africa as one of the best goalkeepers in the world, arguably the best, and then he fluffed that easy ball when Brazil started losing a match that they totally controlled against Holland in the quarterfinal. So, I mean, it took a massive dive. People crucified him in Brazil. And then he went back to Inter. He saw nosedive after winning the treble with Mourinho. It all piled up together, man. And I think a lesser player would have totally disappeared from the game. So it took a lot of balls, to be honest, for him to take an invitation from a relegation-threatened club. And I do believe...
Took a lot of cash as well, as I recall.
Well, but also... but still, taking a lot of cash, you're still going to go to a club that you know you're going to be like a punch bag.
Yeah.
You know, and he could just have said no and gone back to Brazil. Listen, the wages weren't going to be totally uncompetitive in Brazil. But... You know, I think he didn't even know what Kipiao was about. And all of a sudden, you see, talking to him, he kind of like, you walked into Loftus Road the other day and he said, I played for Flamengo, you know, the biggest club in terms of supporters in Brazil. And sometimes the stadium was empty. And all of a sudden, I have these 18,000 people screaming in my ears. It was actually in the piece I wrote for The Guardian this Saturday, by the way, plugging my own thing here. But, you know, he seems generally kind of like, you know, of the opportunity of actually doing something here. And let's not forget, he brought him back to the national team.
Absolutely. And a lot of people talking now about a potential move to clubs like Arsenal, Man United at the end of the season.
I don't think he will if Kipiar stays up.
Oh, okay.
Right? If they go down, it could be something different, especially because I think there will be a massive kind of like cull in QPR. Uh-huh. If they're going to offload the big earners, etc. Obviously, as well, if a huge club comes on knocking. I can't think for him. He seems to be a very loyal guy. He speaks a lot about Fernandes, saying how he calls Fernandes the president. And Fernandes once said, oh, I dream of you lifting the World Cup as a QPR player. And by the way, Julio Cesar is the first QPR player capped, isn't he?
Yeah.
I think the first QPR player capped for Brazil. So it's right. Something that's quite significant. And I don't know, but obviously, I mean, he's a pro. QPR right. staying up, I think it would be a bit harder to take him out. But again, if it's United.
Of course, on another note, with Remy out, it might actually be QPR rather than Odemwingie, who looked like the big fools of the not signing Peter Odemwingie when he's sitting outside in their car park on transfer deadline day. But that's another thought. Greg, you wanted to say something before
just,
we move
yeah,
on?
Yeah, can
to
I just pull conversation away from Brazil and West London yeah. to the South Coast?
And all right, South Coast.
To Southampton, and specifically yes. Ricky Lambert,
ooh.
Who, at 30 years of age, I just think it's heartwarming to see a player who has gone from League One through the Championship and into the Premier League and still kept up a goal scoring record, which is pretty impressive. He's basically scored 1 in 2 since 2005, including his time at Rochdale, all the way through to the Premier League and kept it up. He's now the fourth top scorer in the Premier League alongside Theo Walcott on 11 goals. And I mean, I'm not saying he's a fantastic all round player, but I do think to have had some continuity up front, because they dropped him at the beginning of the season, mm-hmm. I believe he was out for a few games. And since he's come back in, his goals could be absolutely crucial to Southampton staying up, not just like the big name signings they've made. You know.
With Defoe and Sturridge potentially out of the picture for England midweek, should he be getting a reserve call up from that man Roy Hodgson for the England team?
I wouldn't have said so. Right, not going to go that far. I mean, he's 30 years of age. I just think it's really nice that a player such as him can do it in the Premier League and having come through the league.
All right, other stuff then. Spain or Watford? Watford, apparently. There we go.
Well, we can do Spain and Watford.
Yeah, Spain
they've saved
and
from
Watford.
One to the other these
yes,
days.
Yes, cool. Big weekend for the Watford family, wasn't it, Simon?
Oh, yeah, it was a good big weekend for the extended Watford family. What with Italian Watford, Udinese, the mothership, nearly grabbing a draw at Milan, but for a very controversial 94th minute Mario Balotelli penalty.
Yep.
And Spanish Watford, Granada, beating Real Madrid.
Yeah.
With Cristiano Ronaldo scoring for Watford. Cristiano Ronaldo. Who'd have thought that would ever happen?
and what about Watford?
And Watford, the Hertfordshire Watford, came from behind to beat Bolton, their fourth win in 5 games. Well,
right.
Forget about the one other game. And to cement their place in, fourth place in the Championship?
They're within a point of the automatic promotion places. Have they got a big game coming up on Friday or something?
Well, they're playing Crystal Palace on Friday, live on satellite television.
Oh, good.
But such is the quality of Watford's squad currently that a good chunk of it will be away on the international duty midweek.
Oh.
So how that will impact on the performance remains to be seen.
Right.
But certainly, Watford, who probably, for whatever reason, don't have a tremendous reputation for playing fantastic football, are playing fantastic football. And I would encourage anyone who is anywhere near the a venue where the travelling Watford Roadshow is rolling into town
right.
to rock on up and wow at their splendour.
Simon, are you from Watford?
No.
Why are you a Watford fan?
Because there's a long story and
give us edited highlights.
The edited highlights are my family are not sports fans in any way.
Right.
And I think in common with everyone who had to decide for themselves who their team was in the kind of 70s, 80s, I supported Liverpool. But then I supported them. I liked football so much that I started going to games. And I would go to Barnet and Arsenal and Tottenham and Watford, occasionally QPR. And Watford were the first and ultimately the best of those clubs that I went to
right,
see.
Right, good for
and
you.
There was one similar
occasion.
So
you sampled the market before making a decision. I wish more fans would do that.
Did you see John Barnes at Watford?
I did see John Barnes. And there was a similar occasion when I stood in the away end at Vicarage Road when Liverpool came to play and John Barnes scored against them in a Watford win. And I kind of thought, you know, I'm standing in the wrong place here. I'd be much happier over there, jumping up and down. And that was it.
Right. What's your favourite Watford team ever?
I caught the tail end of the Taylor era. And then there have been ups and downs since then. And I guess my favourite season was the season we got promoted to the Premier League for the first time under Taylor, through the playoffs, just because it was so improbable. We'd just been promoted from the third tier, and our players were so unsexy. And there was a kind of narrative drive to it, which was extremely compelling.
Micah Hyde, Simon.
Yeah, well, being one of them. We had several overperforming players that year who went on to underperform the following year. And we beat Bolton through two beautiful goals in the playoff final. And there was an innocence about it. We didn't realise how little fun a small club can have when they get promoted to Premier League. At that time, we thought we might have fun.
Right.
We didn't have fun.
Okay, tell me something. You are a published author on the subject of Watford.
Yeah.
Why do they wear yellow and go by the name The Hornets?
Well, there was basically an arbitrary decision. Watford used to wear blue, and it's interesting the contrast between the way that kind of enforced colour change and identity change was embraced by Watford fans in the 50s and the way Cardiff's forced identity change has gone through. Basically, we were playing in blue, we were underperforming, the board thought, I know what will cheer us up. We'll wear a brighter colour. From now on, we're wearing yellow. Right. And the supporters club thought, yeah, nice idea. We'll buy the kit. And that's basically what happened. And then there was a competition to decide what the name should be that was won by a 9-year-old from Watford called Ian Walker. And basically, yes, they wanted a name that no one else had. Before then, the main nickname was the Brewers because the Benskins Brewery was just behind the club and they had an association.
Well, excited by talk of Spanish Watford, a.k.a. Granada. Let's now dial up Sid Lowe for the Spanish perspective on Real Madrid's loss and one or two other things as well. Sid, are you there?
Hello, James.
Hi, you're there. You're bright and breezy as well by the sound of it today.
I've got a cup of tea.
Ah, fantastic.
And if you've got a cup of tea, nothing else matters.
Well, isn't that so very true? Did you have a good weekend?
Yeah, it wasn't bad at all, thank you.
Right, the Granada-Real Madrid game. Granada winning without a single shot on goal.
Yeah, it's a brilliant stat, isn't it? Yeah, the only shot on goal that Granada had was Cristiano Ronaldo's header, which went in, an own goal for him. Granada weren't great, in truth, but they kept Madrid at bay, partly because Madrid were just awful. I think there's two things happening. One is that kind of tactical problem that we talked about quite a lot really early in the season, which is that when teams wait for Madrid, Madrid sometimes don't have the subtlety in their attacks to unpick really defensive teams. And the other is I think, more about attitude, that Madrid know the league title's gone, and so don't really seem to be particularly trying very hard to get it back.
Sid, in other news this weekend, all sorts of delights, but I do notice that, was it Real Sociedad's president, with this Fuentes court case dominating the headlines, came out and said that he suspects that his own team was doping for 6 years?
Yeah, the former president, Iñaki Badiola. This is an accusation that Badiola made in 2008. And back then, he didn't really provide any evidence that this was true, which isn't necessarily to say it is true or necessarily to say it isn't true, but he didn't provide any evidence it was true. And he ended up apologising in the media, saying that he had perhaps been a bit inexact in some of the things that he said. Now, he's come out and repeated it now, obviously, in light of the Operación Puerto trial, because as part of that trial, there's some handwritten notes from Fuentes in which he lists a series of medications. Now, I must confess, I don't know enough about what those medications actually are and what they actually do. But alongside it, he's written RSOC, R-S-O-C. He was asked in the court what RSOC meant. He said, well, I don't know, it sounds like a brand of good wine to me. Badiola has come out and said, well, no, it's referring to, I assume, this is the problem. I think his choice of language is interesting. He said, I assume it refers to Real Sociedad, but he would have to confirm that. But Badiola claims that when he arrived at the club, going back 6 years, there were a series of payments made through two club doctors to bring medication on board, which he says, again, the choice of language is important, I assume they weren't legal, or else these payments wouldn't have been done on the sly. In black money is the phrase that's used, or in B money. So it's a bit of a murky one, but it certainly points at some concerns. And of course, the thing that in a way is most striking about this is that who was the president of Real Sociedad during a big chunk, I think 4 of those 6 years? The current president of the Spanish League. Ooh. He's come out today and said this isn't true, and he's come out and said he reserves the right to embark on legal action. Now, I don't know about you, but whenever anyone says I reserve to embark the right on legal actions, my response is always the same. Don't bloody well reserve the right to Go do on. It. Do it.
Yeah. Is the impression then that, despite our slightly negative perceptions at the start of the trial, that some big football names might yet get drawn into this doping affair?
The case has been ring-fenced to theoretically only include cycling. So there isn't a legal, a legal desire to lift the lid on other things. Femio Fuentes himself seems to be playing with people a little bit, and he's kind of waving this piece of paper in front of him and then hiding it and saying, oh, I'm not actually going to show you that. And he said the other day that he could name all of the people involved on, who are encoded, written on all these blood bags. And of course, the response to that would be, well, go on then, name them. But the judge said no, because this has been ring-fenced only to cycling, and because it's worth pointing out that this isn't a trial about cheating in sport. It's not a trial about doping. It's a trial about public health. And did Fuentes, during the course of his treatments to various sportsmen, which, as I say, those treatments are not being looked at in terms of whether they meant sportsmen were doping, so much as looked at in terms of whether his medical practices were bad for the health of the people involved. So the trial has been, as I say, it's been ring-fenced into a really weird environment. Now, I imagine that things will emerge from it, but officially, at least, that's not what this trial is about.
Right. Sid, fascinating stuff. Anything coming up this week we should know about?
Well, Spain go to Qatar to play against Uruguay.
Yeah.
A little bit of frustration in Spain, not least from me, of course, but then I'm screamingly biased that Michu's not in the Spain squad.
Right. And also that they're playing in Qatar as well.
Yeah, actually, funny enough, not too many people have moaned about that.
Hmm. All right.
I mean, I suppose it's because compared to Spain's normal friendlies, this isn't too far.
Ah.
They normally travel across to Latin America.
Right, yeah, fair enough.
So this, actually, Qatar's a relatively easy trip from here, and I think time zone-wise, it's only 1 hour different. Mm. So it shouldn't really cause too much problems.
It's one of the glamour midweek international friendlies. That's what that one was, Suarez and Cavani, Forlan potentially.
Yeah, it could be really quite good.
Right, that was Spain. Now, Balotelli, 1,001 days after his last appearance at the San Siro, he returns, and in triumphant fashion. Extraordinary stuff. Of course, he came in midweek through last week back to Milan, and he was only named on the bench among the substitutes. But then just before kickoff, it was a little bit like Ronaldo without the business of the 98 World Cup final. Just before kickoff, whoops, he's in. Pazzini's picked up a mystery injury in the warm-up, and Balotelli starts, almost scored inside the first minute, did score after 25 minutes, got the winner at the death, as you mentioned earlier, Simon, and fantastic stuff. The paper's going crazy about him. Cyclone Balotelli, this morning's Gazetta, and he looked by far the best player on the pitch. Didn't just score the goals, he worked hard.
His run for the first goal was really intelligent. He zipped into the 6-yard box and then just backpedaled away.
Back out, yeah.
He's made it for himself.
He looked very, very good, and he was pinging balls around as well. He looked very happy to be there. He smiled a bit, gave a bit of a wink, all that sort of thing. And of course, they're very excited about the fact that he's the oldest player in their forward line. I mean, he's only 22, so Niang and El Shaarawy, both in their teens still, is all terrific. And Milan continue their extraordinary comeback. They were 13 points behind Inter 10 games ago. They're now level with their crosstown rivals, and only 3 points off the top three. So very much in line for a return
hope
to Champions League
action. Hope for Manchester City yet, then. Hope for Manchester City yet, then.
In what way?
Well, in the Milan are showing a run of good form, and you can eat up the
But you do need to be chasing club. Inter rather than, say, Manchester United, and that might be the key difference. Yeah, Inter, of course, helped them out by losing at the bottom of the table team Siena earlier that day. Siena beating them 3-1 in a pretty dismal performance from the Inter defence, or what passes for it. The other big news that we must mention in Italy was Friday's 4-2 win by Cagliari away at Roma. A victory that saw Roma say goodbye to Zdenek Zeman. Only seems like yesterday that the season began with everybody going, "Ray, Zdenek Zeman's back. Isn't it terrific? We love Zemanlandia." But look at this. Two-thirds of the season has gone, and they've already binned him, poor chap. Why? Well, the 4-2 in itself was a... But even before that, I think it was pretty clear that he was on his way out. The sporting director talking about the fact that Zeman's relationship with other people at the club was carcinogenic, which is a little bit strong. And, of course, falling out with De Rossi, all that kind of thing. But the team, rubbish performance. The goalkeeper, Goykoce in particular, against Caleri. You know that thing when when Rob Green put the ball into his own net? Well, Goykoce did it only more so. There's an innocent cross going by and he grabs it and flips it into his own net. Kind of thing Europol might look at and go, hello. Anyway, goodbye, very much, is a key word, of course, for Zeman. Off he goes. 91 goals were scored in Roma's 23 matches so far, which I think tells a little bit of a story. Now.
Yeah, I just looked at the table there. The second worst defensive record in the league.
Who's worse than them? Eight. Pescara.
Pescara's conceded 48 and Roma have conceded 42. No other team's really close.
All right. Anyway, wow. All right, and at the top it's Juve and Napoli. Very good. Posts. Hey, Simon, you'll enjoy this. Matt Kendrick, for those who might have missed it, the scorers for Hartlepool this weekend were Hartley and Poole. It's a modern-day East 5-4-4-5-5 moment. Amy Lawrence says, after Hartley and Poole yesterday, shouldn't QPR have signed Niall Ranger to go with Park? Maybe not, because then you can have Park Ranger, Queen's Park. And, Dino says, question for Fernando, how well has Ronaldinho been going since his return to the Brazilian League, and will we see him at the World Cup? Fernando.
The Brazilian League has still considered that a player like Ronaldinho is basically a shark swimming in a pool full of Nemos.
Oh.
Yeah, so... Although the competitive levels have increased, I still think it's pretty much below par in comparison to Europe. So no surprise for me that he's doing well there. His move to Flamengo didn't work quite brilliantly, but he showed some flashes of brilliance above all that game, the famous 5-4 against Santos when one of Neymar's goals actually won the Puskas Award. But when he went to Atletico after this acrimonious goodbye and suing Flamengo, etc., he kind of like mutated into this amazing player, scoring great goals. So in terms of form, yes, he deserved his call-up for Brazil. If he's going to last until the World Cup, it's a totally different story because this is a hat-trick of survival attempts for him. He was after the World Cup in 2006, where basically he underperformed at a massive level after being FIFA World Player twice. Dunga tried to save him, ditched him. Then Menezes came in, tried to do it again, ditched it. And now Scolari comes back and gives him a third chance. So it could be a hat-trick of disappointments. I'm inclined to think he might have passed his prime. He might have passed his point of actually doing something for Brazil. Although, he's now going to be playing a more central midfield role, I mean, as we believe, because there's no way he can compete with Neymar for that left side.
Uh-huh.
And on the right side, perhaps he should use more a player like Hulk to free up space for Dani Alves, darting runs. And Oscar, we need to find a place for Oscar there as well. So it seemed that Ronaldinho would be more used as a centre midfielder. If he's going to work, it's a totally different story.
This Wednesday at Wembley, it's a proper Brazil side they're going to put out, Scolari?
He called up pretty much the team that Menezes was putting together. The only notable absence is, two, in my opinion. One is Thiago Silva, he's injured, thigh injury. I mean, he's not even playing for Paris Saint-Germain. The other one is Kaká, although it's debatable. Many people say, okay, he's not playing for Madrid, he should be out of the squad or move on and try to resurrect his Brazil career and also his club career. But I think what I've seen of him in Brazil in the last three games is that even though he hasn't been playing, he slots in perfectly there and helps the kids to settle as well. And Kaká is a massive influence out of the pitch. Again, it's almost like turning him into David Beckham again. And it's kind of thing, oh, it's important, but no. In the match, in football terms, he helped settle the midfield, especially when they were playing without a recognized centre forward, which is a problem Brazil has at the time nowadays. We haven't got like a unanimous number nine. There isn't a player that people say, yeah, this guy is going to be the centre forward for the World Cup. The closest we got for that's Fred, former Lyon reject, that basically, you know, was a top scorer in the Brazilian league, and then we fall again into the Nemo conundrum. He's probably the one that's going to be tried against England. But look at the centre forwards we got. It's either Fred or Luis Fabiano, that guy who's going to be 34 next year. So it's looking pretty weird there.
Interesting. Scolari, this is his first game since his return, is that right?
Yeah, his first game since his return. He returned at the end of November. It's going to be his first time in England as well. So I'm quite curious to see how the England supporters who receive him or greet him when Chelsea reject.
Yeah.
I mean, I think he's got a massive point to prove to himself. I mean, he would love to do something to England. And who else to do something to England than Luis Felipe Scolari? He's responsible for massive upsets for England while commanding Brazil and Portugal. And let's remember, Ronaldinho has a good history with England as well. Although there's a massive, mysterious stat I would like to point out.
A stat?
Yeah.
Right.
Every time Brazil played England in a World Cup, and 58, 62, 70, and 2002, every time they played England in the World Cup, they won the title.
Right.
However, 4 out of 5 times they played England in the year before the World Cup,
yeah,
they went to lose it.
Really?
Yeah.
Because I've got this stat
and that's
here.
2013, isn't it?
So hang on, they play. Oh, they lose that, right? If they didn't lose the game, but they lose the World Cup.
Yes, yeah.
Right,
because okay. In terms of Brazil's superiority in the, against England,
so why are they having a friendly against them now? If they, you know, knowing that, knowing how superstitious Brazilians are,
they need to basically kind of like test themselves against proper opposition. Obviously, is a face
and nothing was available. I'm joking, of course.
I think it's...
They're going to call it off now, Fernando. Yeah. Mentioned it on the pod, Michel. Yeah. You wait for those floodlights to go out.
It's a good team to play. And Brazil, after playing Egypt, you know, Gabon, Iraq, they need to test themselves against proper opposition. They're going to do that after England is Italy. Then they play Russia at Chelsea.
Oh.
At Stamford Bridge, yeah. Then they're going to play France and... Well, also Chile, and there's also a friendly with Switzerland. Okay, hardly well beaten, but still much better than playing against kind of unknown opposition. I mean, it's...
Well, it looks like a proper side. Ronaldinho mentioned Julius Cesar, of course, at the back. David Luiz, you know, the good and the bad. Ramirez, Oscar. Lucas Moura as well. And he's doing brilliantly, they say, at Paris Saint-Germain.
Yeah, but he's not a starter for Brazil. He struggles to find a place there.
Yeah,
because of Neymar. Another thing we might be able to see is Dante. Dante is this guy who is totally unknown in Brazil, but is basically Bayern Munich's stalwart in defense with Jerome Boateng. I think Bayern, last time I saw, they hadn't even shipped. They were in single digits in terms of goals conceded in the Bundesliga, and this guy came out of nowhere for Brazilians. Although he did a very very good stint at Gladbach. Well, actually, he was part of the Gladbach team who made it to the Champions League qualifiers. So it's a very interesting defender, plays well on the ball, and he's got a bonnet as big as David Luiz.
Really? That big?
Yes. Yeah, so we're going to be 2 floppy hair guys in our centre-back partnership, perhaps. Unless Filipão uses Atletico Madrid's Miranda.
Okay.
That guy called up.
All right, 6 players based in Brazil. That's quite unusual, isn't it?
Well, with Menezes took over in 2010 with orders to actually... give more space for players in Brazil. I mean, you know, Neymar, pretty much you can't get take him out of the equation. Fred is, in terms of numbers, the best Brazilian striker at the moment. And Filipão wants to play with a number 9. He's not going to do the Catalan experiment that Menezes was doing, this 4-6-0 attempt. So he's going to use that. Fabiano, he's a recognized striker, although he's very injury-prone. So It's natural now because Brazil are attracting more players, you see.
Is Neymar and Brazil, are they going to take England apart on Wednesday night?
Listen, there will be alterations, and I think the absence of Thiago Silva is something very, very, very interesting. I mean, he's a captain, and his partnership with Luiz is fantastic for Brazil, so there might be a problem there. Having said that, England are yet to beat Brazil since 1990. I mean, Brazil have won 11 out of 23 matches against England and
lost only 2, I think. Is that
3?
Right? 3, is
yeah.
It? Yeah.
The last time Brazil lost was at Wembley in 1990, I mean 1-0. But then again, Brazil haven't won at Wembley since 1995. There were 2 matches since then. Brazil, by the way, my favorite Brazil and England would be that match, 3-1. Juninho scoring a free kick, Ronaldo scoring, Edmundo, and then fantastic goal by Graham Lesseau. Brazil has also hit this Wembley taboo. I mean, and let's remember 2007, they were lucky to get away with a draw. I mean, 92 minutes, Diego, pint-sized midfielder Diego, shows up out of nowhere in England box to head in after John Terry took the lead. Amazing backhand delivery.
Mm. Greg, I know you wanted to ask about Alexandre Dony, the extraordinary story coming out on Monday that he actually... went over to the other side, and
in a Liverpool medical, and when
dying.
Yeah, well, he had a heart attack apparently when he had a medical in the summer, and Liverpool and they didn't mention it because there was some legal issue until now that he's gone and he's gone back to Brazil to fourth division Botafogo. Just wondered what in Brazil have people spoken about that? Is it because he gave a
fourth division Botafogo?
There's two Botafogos apparently.
Yeah, it's actually Botafogo from Ribeirão Preto, a city near São Paulo. That's where Socrates actually used to play.
Oh,
yeah, yeah.
There you go.
I was going to say, they used to be a bit bigger in the 70s, although never at national level. I was going to say, well, Donner gave this interview to a Brazilian website, globosporte.com, where he said, yes, I had a heart failure thing when I was doing a medical for Liverpool and I almost died.
But hey, this was just a routine medical, was it?
Yes, yeah. A routine medical. There was no reason for that. And to be honest, he said that the doctor told him to stop playing. The doctor would say, my medical advice for you is to stop playing.
I don't know whether he will play again, will he? I know he's gone there and he's not allowed to play until the summer.
Until next year. He's trying to make a comeback in 2014.
I mean, it's very sad because he was getting quite a lot of criticism off fans who didn't know. Liverpool didn't speak about it. He didn't speak about it. It was just like, where's Donny gone? We saw him once and he got sent off at Blackburn and it was like, this player's gone. And we spent a few million on him from Roma. So anyway, good luck to him.
If you are going to have a heart attack, do it while you're in a room full of doctors.
Yeah, that's very true. Yeah.
Fair point. Yeah. Fair point. All right. Well, that's all been fascinating. To finish off today, let's get a quick checkup on the Africa Cup of Nations, where, of course, the weekend saw drama galore with teams booking their places in the semi-finals this Wednesday. Surprisingly, it is Burkina Faso who will be taking on Ghana, while Mali, who put out South Africa, the host, will be up against Nigeria, who beat Ivory Coast. Here comes Jonathan Wilson at you.
Hi, how you doing?
Excellent, very well. Where are you in the wide world of South African tournament football?
I'm in a lounge at Johannesburg Airport, waiting for flight to Nelspruit.
All right. And you're heading out there for one of the semi-finals?
That's right, yeah.
Which one?
Ghana against Burkina.
Right, okay. Did you have a good weekend? What was your highlight?
Yeah, it was fantastic. I went to Durban for the South African Mali game, which is absolutely packed stadium, great atmosphere. And that's a fantastic stadium, the most Mbeki in Durban. I think it's probably the best of the World Cup stadium. And South Africa actually played very well. I mean, they were on top, one lap after 50-odd minutes, and the conceded pretty much against them on the play. And they sort of folded at that. Which I think sort of betrays their lack of confidence. And Mali sort of held it and were quite comfortable and took it to penalties. As Africa were sort of clearly knackered by then. And as often happens, a more tired team lost the shootout. And then went on from there to Rustenburg yesterday and saw Nigeria beat Cote d'Ivoire.
Yet again, the golden generation failing to live up to their promise, Jonathan. And what were the scenes like at the end?
Oh, in Nigeria, celebrations were grabbing S. Ambrose doing somersaults down the running track in front of the Nigerian fans. It were quite a lot. It was probably 4,000 or 5,000 there, all in their green and white. And the Ivorians just sort of collapsed on the pitch, sort of devastated that this has happened again. I mean, 2006, they lost in the final to Egypt. And I guess, Egypt were hosts, so they were probably the favourites. But since then, Ivory Coast has been a clear favourite for every tournament. And they keep losing. Every time they come up against a good team in the knockout phase, they just can't do it. And I think it really has become a big psychological issue for them. They're 1-0 down at half time, deservedly so yesterday. They came back in the second half, equalised very early in the second half, looked a better side, and then conceded a slightly unfortunate goal. I mean, you can blame the defending. Sunday and Bar ran through two sort of slightly weak challenges. His shot flicked off Sol Bamba on the way in. And that was 12 minutes to go, and they just couldn't pick themselves up from that. You could almost see the belief had drained out of them, just that sense of, oh God, it's happening again.
So now, does everything shape up then for a Ghana-Nigeria final then, or can Burkina Faso and Mali change all that?
I think Ghana certainly should beat Burkina. There's Lassane Traore, who's their main attacking threat. He scored three goals. He looked the sharpest ball in the tournament until he got a thigh injury in the final group game. But they defensively are good. They've only let in one goal in four games. They've gone 367 minutes, I think it is, without conceding a goal.
Wow.
So they will keep it tight. It will be difficult for Ghana to score, but they should get through that. I think the Mali-Nigeria game isn't as much tighter. I think this is a very good Mali side. I think perhaps not that exciting, but they're well organised. They've dug it through midfield. And I think they are motivated by what's happening at home. They do have this great sense of responsibility. And Ted Okeyeter, who is a very eloquent speaker, a very intelligent man, he said repeatedly, and he was saying this last year even as well, that they have this great sense that they can give something back to their nation. It's a chance for them as footballers to do something. So I think that motivation with the organisation I think that Nigeria game is 50-50. But obviously, a Ghana-Nigeria final, a big West African clash of two of the great giants, yeah, it would be fantastic for the tournament.
All right, well, the Eagle Derby then, the Eagles against Super Eagles, of course, and then Stallions and Black Stars in the other one. John, that's terrific. I hope you enjoy those two matches on Wednesday, and then we'll catch up with you after that, if we may.
Excellent, yeah. Brilliant. Look forward to it.
Thanks, Jonathan.
Cheers, thanks.
Well, that's another Monday roundup on events in the world of football. Fernando, I don't know if there's been any updates on All Football Is Bent.
Breaking story? No, not as I'm concerned. Can I just remember something? Alexandre Pato, which basically caused news by going back to Brazil, the biggest transfer ever involving a Brazilian player returning, because a lot of people saying it's the biggest ever. It's not. Carlos Tevez costed more money than him when he went to Corinthians. But, well, he kept this fantastic record. Every time he makes his debut for a team, he scores. It was like that for Internacional in Brazil, for Milan, for the Brazilian team in London against Sweden. And then for Corinthians now, only 3 minutes after he was on the pitch, and after three touches, he scored one of the Corinthians' goals against a team called Oeste. They won 5-0 the São Paulo State League. Mm-hmm. It's unbelievable that he
should change clubs more often, basically.
Yeah. He was quite happy to see him. I mean, he seems to be finally kind of not getting injured every time he sneezes. So it's fundamental we get guys like him ready. Because, you know, we might need him in the World Cup. He's still quite young. But the thing is, will his body actually sustain the strain?
And what about his broken heart? That long-distance relationship with Barbara Berlusconi? All important question.
He is my hero because I hate Milan. So he's doing something that every anti-Milanista wants to do is to Berlusconi, even though we're doing it by proxy, but it's fine.
All right, then.
Fernando, a question. Fernando, how old are you?
I'll be 40 next March.
It's great seeing a Brazilian at that age still at the top of his game, because all we've talked about today is Brazilians burning out early, haven't we?
Yeah, it's true.
Yeah, Kaká and Mike on before, Ronaldinho. Right. But, you know, there's Fernando still going strong.
Yep.
Great. Thanks, man. It's a caffeine.
Oh, yeah. Right.
Magnificent. Fernando, so good to have you back. Are you going along to the game on Wednesday?
Yes, I'll be there. I'll be hoping to finally see Brazil winning at Wembley, because I haven't seen it yet. I mean, it's an amazing stadium, and I hope this is going to be a great match.
Cool.
But also, I have the impression that England might nick this one. I got this eerie feeling. I hope they don't, because I hate England supporters. Oh, yeah, do well, Brazil, etc. But anyway.
That wasn't an English supporter who just wandered into the pod. That was actually Fernando doing an impression, by the way. Magnificent stuff. Thank you, Fernando, for stepping by.
Oh, it's a pleasure. I missed you guys.
Yeah, us too. Simon Burton, thank you very much.
Been a blast.
Brilliant stuff. Quick prediction.
You know, it's a friendly, I don't care. Yeah.
Okay, that's a good one. And Greg?
Yeah, cheers, James. And Brazil 2-0.
Oh, lovely. Mm-hmm. Thanks for being bothered. Lovely. Thank you, listeners. Thank you, producer Ben. And we'll be back on Thursday. Do join us then.